Welcome to Season 4 of Marcus Oldham Ag Talk, the podcast where we dive deep into the world of agriculture. Stories to challenge your views, expert insights, and the latest thinking that relates to ag. Hosted by David Cornish, we're thrilled to guide you through the dynamic and ever-evolving landscape of agriculture. So buckle up and get ready for another season of Ag Talk. Whether you're a seasoned ag industry pro, a current student, or simply someone who's passionate about agriculture, there's something here for you. Our guests are industry thought leaders, farmers, researchers, and entrepreneurs who are making a difference in the ag world one innovation at a time. Season 4 of Marcus Oldham Ag Talk's our best one yet, and we can't wait to have you on board. Thanks for tuning in, and let's get ready to explore the wonderful world of agriculture together.
It's my pleasure today to welcome Joanne Stevenson from Resilient Organisations here today. She's a principal consultant at the organisation. Over the past decade, Joanne has accumulated post-disaster research and consulting experience in several countries, examining recovery, resilience of communities, economies and organisations. She enjoys grappling with complex systems and developing practical solutions to work with these using her background in geospatial assessment and network analysis. So what's that got to do with agriculture? Well, I'll tell you. I was very lucky to meet Jo and her husband at the Gums Merino Stud near Cheviot in South Island of New Zealand. It was one of the best tours or best visits I've ever been on, mainly because of what they talked about from a farming operation, from a personal operation, and just a general community organisation. And I thought it was a really good story, which I'm very pleased to say Jo has joined us here today to talk about. And so welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, Joanne, so I think, first of all, I've mentioned that you live in Cheviot, New Zealand, which is South Island, New Zealand.
Yep.
Anyone would realise your accent doesn't sound very Kiwi-like. So I think what would be really great to start off with is a brief history, how you ended up in Cheviot.
Sure, yeah. It's a winding path. So I started my life in the metro area of Chicago, 9.5 million people. Kiwis can't believe the fact that I grew up and I didn't see the ocean until I was an adult. But when I was doing my undergrad in central Illinois, there was a series of tornadoes that happened. And I became fascinated with disasters and recovery from disasters. And at the same time, I was also learning to play rugby and ended up meeting a handsome Kiwi fella who was my coach. And we hooked up and we've kind of gone on this journey together. So from Illinois, I finished my degree and went traveling, did the OE, moved to the UK, and there was a series of record-breaking floods in Northern England. So I started working at the University of Dundee, looking at the reinsurance industry's response to the sort of changing flood landscape in Europe. And it was an incredible experience. So from there, I got an offer to do my master's degree fully funded at the Hazards and Vulnerability Research Institute in South Carolina. And was there in time for one of the worst hurricane seasons to hit the U.S. southeast. And so I spent a few years actually tracking long-term recovery from Hurricane Katrina, which, I mean, anybody who followed that story even marginally knows was a tremendous education in what not to do, and also looking at the power and strength of communities and the importance of business and economies in actually helping places rebuild. And from there, we decided to kind of pursue the quiet life, move back to New Zealand. So my husband's a Kiwi. And we moved to Christchurch in June of 2010, just in time for the September 2010 earthquake in Christchurch. So it just seemed like fate. You know, I'd become fascinated with disasters. I've studied disasters. So I got work consulting immediately out of that. You know, I'd made connections when I first landed. And so it just launched me into this really interesting exploration of recovery from that disaster. And then once I was given had an opportunity to do my PhD and start a company with my colleagues called Resilient Organizations. And in 2014, my husband and I decided to move up to the family farm in Cheviot. And so we were kind of settling into the farming life. I was still doing bits of pieces of work in the resilience and disaster space. And as soon as we came back to the farm, we stepped into a three-year drought. And this was interspersed by the 2016 Kaikoura earthquakes. And then just as we were coming out of that recovery, we got caught up in the Mbovis, introduction of the Mbovis to New Zealand for the first time ever, and all of the interesting quarantine and response for the eradication of that disease from New Zealand. So to say that I'm an expert in resilience and disasters is kind of an understatement. I've studied it, I've lived it, and I've also had an amazing opportunity to consult with businesses one-on-one. So I live and breathe this stuff, David.
I've got Joe coming over to Australia in May the 5th for the leadership course. So if anyone wants to just in the Geelong area wants to take a week-long holiday, maybe a good time to do it. No, sorry, Joe. I mean, it is. You know, some of those. We make light of those crises, but they were significant. And I think one of the things that I really rung home to me is when probably for Australians who don't know where Cheviot is, there's probably two roads: one road in, one road out. Mm-hmm. And there was a point where, when the earthquake, when Cheviot was completely blocked out from the outside world. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah. For a short period of time, we couldn't get out of Cheviot, and for quite a few months, we couldn't get north. State Highway 1 was closed. Kaikoura was completely cut off. And the entire coastline, we drive up to Kaikoura all the time, and there was uplift that was so significant, it actually changed the entire coastline. Mm. So it's just, you know, what it looked like before 2016 is completely changed. It was a very significant event.
Okay, so let's now take some of those learnings and look at it from a, I suppose, from an organisation perspective, from a farming perspective, but more importantly, from a person perspective, because I think that's something that agriculture or family business is a people business, and we can't, you know, and again, one of the things that I kept on reflecting on when you were talking was this concept around what does it mean to me, what does it mean to my organisation, and how is important for farming, especially in Australia where we do have these things called droughts, real droughts. No,
yeah, you guys really do it better.
Yeah,
you do it the best.
Again, it's something that we're not proud of, but I think we can do it pretty well. We have commodity slumps, yada, 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 and just the stress that puts on family farming operations. I picked up an article that you co-wrote a couple of years ago, and there was a quote in it that really resounded to me, and it was this concept, this quote being, resilient farmers thrive in the face of adversity. Now, there's two things that I'd like to explore with you. Number one is this concept of resilience, and one of the problems is that obviously sometimes we see that it's been overused, and concept of adversity. What is adversity? Because I think sometimes we face challenges, but when does a challenge become an adversity, or is that not the situation? And why is it that resilient? Okay, yeah, the whole things that I want to unpack there. There's a whole lot of things that I want to look at within that quote. So let's just start off with, in your words, what do you think that quote is saying to you?
Well, I'd like to just kind of go back to your original statement around the fact that personal resilience, that idea of individuals and farming are so intertwined that it's essential to look at that. So I come from a very much an economics, social systems background, and I hadn't done a huge amount of work before I started working with Jack Cox, who's the co-author on that paper on personal resilience. But the more I delved into agriculture and farming resilience in particular, and being on my own farm, the more I realized that you really can't separate the individual from the business. It is so intertwined. There's family legacy there. There's personal identity. There's passion. And all of that is tied up into the economics and the business side of things. So I think your observation there is dead right. But it's important in any business, but it's actually the personal side of things is completely undeniable and absolutely critical to everything in farming. So resilient farmers, so let's start there. So what is resilience? Resilience is the ability to basically get knocked down and get back up again. So I often use resilience and agility together. So if you think of, you know, a rugby player, I played rugby, as I mentioned, and you wouldn't know it to look at me. I used to be very quick. That was how I got away with that.
So did I, Joe, but to look at me, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So resilience is essentially the ability to with stand disruption and recover quickly. And agility is the ability to move quickly and easily. So if you think of a rugby player, you think of that back, you know, that was me. I was floating around in the back, and you have somebody barreling down the pitch at you, and you can step out of the way. You can see that change coming and you can move quickly. Okay. So that's agility. Resilience is even the best rugby player in the world is going to get hit. You can see it coming. You're still going to get hit. You might not see the hit coming. You get slammed. And so resilience is the ability to get slammed and have the resources, the skill, the plan to get back on your feet and continue playing as quickly as possible. Okay. So when we talk about resilient farmers facing adversity, resilience isn't a given. It's a skill. It's something that can be built up and eroded over time. I often say resilience is a journey. So you don't just accumulate resilience through your life. It can actually, you think of it like an immune system. You grow, you have resource. At some points in your life, if you think life, you've had times where you've had lots of resources, lots of support. So if you got hit by something, some kind of disruption, you're going to be able to pull on all of those things to get back and get moving. And there's other points in your life where, you know, like us on farm, having a drought and an earthquake and then bovis in quick succession, our resources are getting eroded. And so you might have less ability to bounce back quickly for that third, fourth disaster in a few years. But at the same time, you've been accumulating skills and networks. And so hopefully, you know, if you have a growth mindset, it balances out. Going to that concept of adversity. So adversity can come in so many forms, as I'm sure everybody listening knows. So in that paper that you referred to, Jack and I identified there, he did case studies with farmers across New Zealand and focused on five different sort of disruptive impacts. So he had a health crisis that he covered. You have natural disasters. So we don't use that term natural disasters because there is no natural disaster. An earthquake happens, and if it doesn't impact a building or infrastructure, it's not a disaster, but that's a side conversation. And then you can have financial crises, which I think a lot of, especially Kiwi farmers, probably still in Australia as well, are feeling the pinch of impending financial disruption, if not crisis. And you can have family upsets. And so this is one that really does catch people off guard. A divorce is one of the most, I don't know if statistically it's the most common, but it's the one that I've seen the most likely to actually end farming partnerships, ending farming businesses. And then personal loss. So that's, you know, the loss of a key person in your business, death. And so those are types of adversity, but there's so many different types. And when we talk about, so I often use the terms change and crisis interchangeably, and I think it's just a matter of timing. So if you see a change coming, and, you know, we'll go back to that term agility, and you have the wherewithal and the ability to step out of the way, then it's just a change. You've changed your track and you've not been impacted. And a crisis means that for whatever reason, you weren't able to escape impact, and now you're having to change in the face of disruption. Does that make sense, David?
Yeah, it does. But it's interesting. You're talking about that point about resilience, ebbs and flows. Mm-hmm. While you were talking, I was thinking back on my own life. You know, we've had some challenges. My wife had a cancer called multiple myeloma, which at a young age, which is, you know, not great at all. And I remember at the time, it sort of was like, well, we're going into battle, you know, and so it was probably one of the most challenging points of my time, but it was also one of the times where there was clarity around what we needed to do. So mm-hmm. we got through that, luckily, you know, again, thanks to great science, thanks to a few other things, it was pretty touch and go at times. But but while we were in that stage, I didn't feel personally, it was you know, you always had people come and say, how do you feel? And they give you what I call that the look. And I'm going, I'm not great, but, you know, I had a job in front of me and I could do it. I could see what I was doing.
Yeah.
Other times where the actual battle, if I can put it that way, and probably not the right word, was not as clear, sometimes I felt my resilience not as strong, and littler things could knock me off my stool a lot easier. And yeah. I see that sometimes with, and again, you get the old, the old timers, my time was a lot harder sort of things, and we had droughts and we're shooting sheep and things like that. And then you see people talking about, oh, well, it's tough at the moment, or you don't know what tough is when we had 20% interest rate sort of thing versus you're complaining about 7. So, you know, get over it sort of thing. But I'm not saying that in an adverse perspective, but this ability to deal with different situations, and when the focus is unclear, sometimes makes it more blurry, makes it harder.
That's dead right. Yeah, and actually what you're hitting on there, I mean, yeah, thank you for sharing that story. That's an incredible example. And I think what you're hitting on there is when I talk about burnout, when I talk to people about burnout, a lot of the time people blame themselves for not being resilient enough. You know, they're in a job, and this is sort of a side concept, but probably really relevant to people in the industries that would be listening to this podcast. Burnout happens to people who are really passionate about what they're doing. It happens to people who derive a sense of identity from what they do. It happens to people who are high performers, highly competitive. And part of that comes from the fact that, okay, so their identity is all tied up in it. When they start to get a mismatch between what the demands are and what the resources are is when you start to see people falling apart. Hmm. So when you have a lack of autonomy, so when you start talking about that uncertainty in New Zealand under the previous government, and we're starting to see the unraveling of it, but under the previous government, we started to see a lot of regulation that felt like it was being put on top of farmers, and we just had to figure out how we were going to survive within this completely new context. So people who are so used to working for themselves and surviving all kinds of adversity, all of a sudden are having power taken out of their hands. And then you start seeing people start to collapse. So like you said, in your example, you knew exactly what you were supposed to be doing. You were going to beat this cancer together as a family. The where you were driving to was really clear. But when you have that clarity and that autonomy removed from you, it can be really challenging to your identity. Same thing with lack of support. So when you have a crisis that's really obvious and easy to explain to other people, you can actually tap into networks easier. So not saying that your experience was easier, that cancer or anything like that or death is easy, but there's a clarity, there's an ability to explain it to other people. People are willing and ready to come to you for support. You'll find that people who are navigating complex mental health crises that are less easy to tell people about, or, you know, when people are facing depression or something even more, bipolar disorder or something that's harder to tell people about and explain, it's much harder to access networks and to access support. Mm. And if you're going through a financial crisis on your farm, sometimes it's easier when everybody's going through that financial crisis, because then you can talk to people about it and you can ask people what they're doing. If it's a financial crisis that you're going through, you know, that's not at the same time as everybody else, then you'll see people's resilience starting to waver and their ability to cope waver, because they're not able to access and reach out for support as easily.
Yeah, I think you raise a couple of really valid points. And again, as I get older and I see my friends and myself, some of the experiences we've gone through, mental health, the inability for us to communicate and feel like if I had a broken leg with cancer, you know, you talked about cancer and suddenly everyone was on it. We had Eskies at our back door every night with food from the people who didn't even know us. But that was just the way we did it, because Lib was down in Melbourne in hospital and sort of things like that. Mental health, people will sort of take we don't know how to, what do we do here? How do we communicate it? We don't talk about it. And in a family, in a farming community, area, it becomes even more intense, because it's a smaller population and people sort of know everyone, and it just seems to get harder rather than being easier.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Yeah, you're more vulnerable because people have known you your whole life and they know your family, and it can actually be really hard to put yourself in a position where you're saying I'm unable to cope, because there's so many people depending on you. There's so many people that know you, and just a smaller population, fewer people are going to have the same exact personal experience as you. And so, yeah, we talk about finding communities of support when everyone's going through, you know, it was hard for us. We were one of the first farms, I can say this now, but we were one of the first farms in our district to be affected by Mycoplasma bovis. And that was a really hard time because we were unsure when to tell our neighbors because it, you know, it's contagious. It could have affected them. And so that initial point where we're, you know, because of our cattle trading policy, which we actually implemented following the drought to give ourselves a bit more resilience and flexibility, put us in a position of being exposed to this new disaster, this new, you know, pest. It was those early phases where it was really difficult, and it actually became way easier when everybody else got it.
Yeah,
and that sounds terrible,
yeah.
It opens up the support channels. More people have experience. More people can kind of nod along and go, "Oh yes, I know exactly what you mean," without you having to explain it, or you know, people feel threatened by something that's new and something that they haven't experienced before.
So, I suppose the question is, how do we change that? Because in my experience, that the sooner we can talk about and communicate, and maybe that's just me, maybe that's just my personality, but I see that. And I want to bring a couple of threads together here. Is one is the divorce, mental health, only because of just recently over the last 6 months, two close friends who have farming operations are dealing with divorce. And the ramifications of that, both from a mental health perspective, but also from family dynamics. And I'm not just talking about the nuclear family, but because our families are involved in the farming situation, it becomes reinforced. And rather than people, I think the word is people looking at how can we support everyone getting through that, it's how can we almost protect our patch, which then becomes reinforced and actually making the situation worse.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I'm not an expert in this particular field, but it comes down to those same conversations that we have around succession. So succession is something, again, that can make or break family businesses. And having conversations early, and I talk about this a lot, you know, this is something that a lot of people say, but the soft stuff is the hard stuff.
Yeah.
And doing that soft stuff first and understanding where people are and where people's expectations are can save a lot of pain later. And so I think that divorce is a similar sort of conversation to succession. Is where are we all trying to get? What are we trying to achieve? How can we sort everyone out so that we're kind of maintaining the core of where everyone's trying to go? When we talk about organizational resilience, my company, Resilient Organizations, has this triangle chart, which I think you've seen. And there's three categories of indicators that we look at when we look at businesses that are able to cope really well with change and disruption. And so those are leadership and culture, networks and relationships, and change readiness, which is sort of a mindset and approach to planning and change. So the point I was heading toward there was, in cultures. So when we think about what a really, really good business culture is, if you kind of take a minute and think about the best team that you were ever part of, one that was able to, that felt good, you were excited to show up every day, whether that was a team at work or a rugby team or whoever, great cultures aren't always oriented around happiness and harmony. So we'll get calls from businesses who want to come and do a really fun workshop with their staff or, you know, they'll be doing silly fun things and it's actually not shifting the dial at all on staff engagement and staff outcomes and productivity. What great cultures are based on is collectively solving hard problems. And they're strengthened by high candor feedback, trust, clarity, and honesty about where the team is and where it should be. And the same thing goes in families. If you can establish a culture at the beginning, when your marriage is going well, while your children are kind of still figuring out what they want to do or whatever it is, early on, if you establish a culture in your business or in your family or both, you know, in the case of farming, if you can orient that culture around, we are collectively solving hard problems. We're in this together. I don't care how junior you are. If you're a shepherd that we just hired 2 months ago, I want your I want you to be looking for problems, to tell me when things aren't working. I want to create that culture of we're all in this and we're all solving hard problems. You have to establish a culture in marriage. This is going to be even harder than in the business of yep. high candor feedback, because nobody wants to hurt their spouse's feelings. Nobody wants to say, you know, the thing that you're doing is making me really unhappy. And so you let things build and build. And it can be really hard to advocate for yourself in those situations.
Yes.
But if you have that culture of high candor feedback, that comes in handy over and over again when you're navigating hard times. And then I've always said, I'm a people pleaser. It's just part of my nature. And so when I give somebody feedback, I've really had to work on clarity is kindness. So I often thought of kindness as burying the hard thing you had to say in lots of compliments and niceties. You know, you're amazing when you come to work. Like, I love it. And when you get here, it's like you're such a high impact person. It's just really bothering me that you're an hour late every day. But if you could, I mean, like, if you have problems getting to work, just let me know. And like, really, I could say, look, you have to be here on time.
Yeah.
and leave it at that. And that is kindness. Being clear is kind.
Because again, we, you know, the old adage is, and again, excuse the language, but maybe an Australian thing, that the shit sandwich. In other words,
yes.
People would start off with all this fluff,
yeah,
then get to the point of what they want to get to, and then finish off with fluff. So, I actually think it's a really bad way of giving feedback.
I agree.
Because you miss the point. But it makes us feel better that we're actually not just criticizing a person. So when you mean candid. Obviously, you don't mean destructive, but I mean, what do you mean by candid?
Oh, when I say candor, I mean...
Or candor, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it just has to be honest. You just have to say, this isn't working for me. Mm. Or, you know, you have to create a culture of honesty and tough feedback.
Mm.
When I do workshops or when I work with teams, I do a survey at the end and I say, I really want to hear where things didn't work.
Mm.
It helps me. I love to hear when things did work. I love that feeling at the end of, you know, engaging with a business and they're all saying, wow, that was great. That was amazing. Pat on the back. But, you know, as with anything, the real gold comes when somebody says, I really wish we could have gotten to, you know, more application of this topic that you came with and stuff. So creating a culture where it's okay to say this isn't something that's working is critical when you get into really tough situations, because you're going to need to be making decisions very quickly. You're going to need to be able to trust the people that you're with to have your back and to go on the journey with you. And you can't do that if you don't have a culture of honesty and being able to say the hard things that need to be said.
Sorry, I just, because it's making me think, along the lines of, if you're an organization where that hasn't been the case and you come in as a leader and you suddenly start doing that, you need to, obviously the environment of trust is critical, that this will be used in a constructive manner. How do you demonstrate that or create that this will be trusted and that's okay? I've seen where people needed to be given candid feedback because of what they've done to someone else in the team, and that team member, and that's been given them, but the team member who suddenly feels disempowered, this is a person who, but you're trying to point to that person is that we can't have that type of behavior within this organization, but they feel like they'll be resented by the person that feedback was given to. So, it's just... You want to be candid, you want to create that trust, but if it ain't there to start off with and other people in the organization aren't providing that, I mean, in a family business, it's probably a little bit easier because you have an overarching radar, although family's a family, that makes it add another dynamic. I take that back. But within how do you create that environment where candid feedback, which I think is, and I agree with you, is one of the most important things that you can give or receive, is going to be taken in the spirit to which it's required.
Yeah. I think what you've identified as one of the most difficult things for new leaders coming into a business is often a new leader is coming into the business because there has been a leadership change. And you can be walking into a very low trust situation. You can be walking into a situation where silos have started to form. So a silo in a business context is teams that just work with each other. There's low trust. There's not a lot of communication between those teams. And so actually rebuilding trust, like in a family, in a relationship, in a marriage, it can't be done overnight. Mm. It's a multi-step process, and it has to be done with sort of patience, and it has to be done through leading through example. So some ways to do this, if, let's just imagine, you know, you've just been appointed a CEO of a new organization, the old CEO left in disgrace, and the team's kind of in this really low trust situation. What you'd go in is you go in and kind of get the lay of the land. I often use the terms, name it, notice it, navigate it. So I say this in when I'm talking about personal and emotional resilience, but this is always a great place to start when you're dealing with people. So this framework, notice it, name it, navigate, or name it, tame it, if you like rhyming schemes. Noticing it is actually taking the time to observe. Okay, so actually figuring out what's going on. And when in an emotional context, I talk about tuning into your body. So if we're thinking about anger or feeling upset, you're actually just noticing the physical feelings in your body. Naming it would be saying, I'm feeling angry. And then navigating it is finding the ways past those negative feelings. But in this context, if you're coming into a situation that's a low trust situation or sort of a dysfunctional team, just sitting down and going, how are people taking accountability for their actions in this organization? Is there a lot of finger pointing? Is there a lot of blaming? And how can I, as a leader, start to establish extreme ownership of the things that you do? So you can start by leading and saying, oh, when something happened, oh, I didn't explain that to you well enough. So I was just doing a workshop on Monday, and I walked people through this exercise that I've done a number of times, and somebody raised their hand and asked a question that showed that they were just completely misunderstanding the exercise. Mm. And I said, oh, wow, I'm really sorry. I didn't explain that clearly enough for you. I didn't tease them, because a lot of the people in the room did get it.
Yeah.
And that person didn't. And I took that on me. I said, oh, I'm sorry. I didn't explain that clearly enough. Let me re-explain it in a way that makes sense. And then we all got back on the same page. So if you blame somebody, and it's so easy to do, especially in a family situation where you're more comfortable and you know, Jean, she just never listens, you know, instead of going, no, I'm sorry, I didn't explain that in a way, or I didn't come to you in a way that you could hear me. Another thing is paying attention to the canaries in the coal mine. So you have, you know, you might have a person in your organization who's really difficult or demanding or arrogant, and they can spoil that whole team dynamic. Yeah. And so figuring out where you need to target your resources could be another good way to do it. Looking for silos, doing postmorts on where you start to practice. Like, so you could do it in a contained thing. So we've had a project, it didn't go well. Hey, let's talk about it. And then you can demonstrate your ownership of where things went wrong and ask candid questions about what did go wrong in the team. So those are some, you know, practical ways that you can start to address that.
And I think, especially in agriculture, where, you know, you go to some organisations where people have grown out on pastoral enterprises, for instance, they don't have that engagement or interaction that say people working in a city mm-hmm. do, and they've learnt, well, they become managers or leaders of those teams purely from their technical skills. They're mm-hmm. good with cattle, they're good with sheep, they're good with tractors, whatever it is. Ipso facto, we've got no one else and we're just going to put them in charge of those positions. Now, from their perspective, they've only learnt by doing or how they've been taught. So really interesting when I've worked with sort of like the people coming through underneath them, they go, David is really good at his job, but he's shit at managing people.
Yeah.
So it's not that they purposely do it, is that they're just not aware of it.
No.
And sometimes when you try and point things out, they say, mate, that's the way I did it. I got my ass kicked and mm-hmm. it worked for me and look at me now. And you sort of, you want to have that discussion. Might have happened in 20, 30 years ago, mate, but is that the way to do it these days?
Yeah.
And are you actually engaging your team in a way that's going to result in better outcomes? They might not ever be you, but A, you're creating an atmosphere where no one wants to work. And that's sort of like getting people to stand in front of the mirror is a really interesting thing. But that comes with trust too, doesn't it, Joanne, in that we've got to allow them to see, I mean, support them with regards to identifying their issues and then helping them rather than seeing that as a weakness that we need to bury from our boss.
Yep. Yeah. Self-awareness is one of the leading indicators of a good leader. It's it's an amazing indicator, and it's something that, you know, have you heard of the Johari window?
Yes. My facilitator is very big on it. One of my you'll meet James. He loves it.
Yeah. So it's a way of kind of understanding the way that you understand yourself and the way that other people experience you and looking for where your understanding gaps are. So where your blind spots are.
Hmm.
And so even the most self-aware person is going to have some blind spots, the inability to see where they're letting other people down.
Yep.
And a good leader will do what they can to actually get information and the things that they can't see about themselves and to improve.
Yeah. So just working on that triangle, you talk about leadership and culture, change ready, and network and relationships, all of which I think we could do a podcast on each of them.
Absolutely.
But in summary, if we have a well-run organization, so we always like to benchmark ourselves, I suppose, in a way. Mm-hmm. What are the type of main indicators that you're looking for to say, okay, that's something that you should look for in a well-run organization, or that's a red flag that you need to deal with before you know, that's the 20% that's going to give you 80% return.
Mm. Yeah, well, this is a benchmarking tool. So all 13 indicators can be benchmarked in against other organizations that we've surveyed. We do talk about prioritizing resilience investment. So the best place to start would be to actually do an assessment about where you are as an organization, because you might already be nailing, all aspects of your change readiness. This is in a classic sort of organization. Let's think of Boeing. So Boeing is an engineering firm historically. And so that's, aircraft manufacturer, big organization in the States. And they had really great risk management strategies. They've had amazing manufacturing processes. And so they've done all that stress testing plans, planning strategies that, so if you look at the triangle, that change readiness corner, they've nailed it.
Yep.
Where they were really falling down was in the culture component. So in a recent release of internal documents from Boeing to Congress, to the U.S. Congress, they found that there was truly alarming culture issues in the organization, and people weren't feeling heard, and they were starting to develop sort of internal silos and not feeling, like we were just talking about, that trust to report small issues. And ultimately, it resulted in the deaths of 346 people. Because the 737 MAX airliner crashed.
Mm.
And they've had, that is not the last disaster they've had since. I mean, it's really kind of showing the actual life and death consequences of not having your culture sorted in your organization.
They had a few issues just the other day, didn't they, with a Dreamliner?
Yes. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Mm.
So, yeah, the fun goes on for them. Yeah. But so I guess if I was going to say just generally, if you're completely even across all of these indicators that we look at of resilience, the best place to invest usually is in leadership and culture.
Yep.
But also, my expertise, a lot of the research that I did following the Christchurch earthquakes was on networks.
Yeah.
And so how organizations use networks to help themselves. And this comes into that when I was talking about the resilience journey earlier, those times when maybe you've been hit financially, maybe you've had a key person loss, maybe all of those things that you tend to rely on to do well have been eroded. If you have good networks, you can still access those things, or you can support yourself. So you can say, look, I need a little bit more financing, or you can go to your suppliers that you have an established relationship with and say, look, I'm going to be a little bit late on payment. And if you've already done the work to establish those trusts and managed your network as a strategic resource, which it most certainly is, that's going to be something that props you up in really, really tough times. So I'm not giving you a straight answer because I think all of these things matter.
I don't think there is a straight answer. I was going to come onto that networks because I found during COVID, for instance, when I was actually as a consultant many years ago and working on my own, mm-hmm. I found that really detrimental to my mental health because I wasn't having that relationships with other people face to face or whatever on a daily basis, whether it was, and that was during work, you know. Now, as a farmer, I think it becomes even harder because by the very nature, you're working on your own. So that actually investment of getting off farm, whether it's, I don't care what it is, but it was just with other, you know, whether it's motorbike riding, whether it's shooting, I don't care. But mm-hmm. having that ability to just engage with other people from a mental health perspective was so important.
Yeah. Yeah. I talk a lot about the self-care battery. And so this is the idea that, well, as people in business, but especially as farmers who are often kind of the core of their business, you are the productivity engine, the everything of your business. You have to be making sure that you are ready for the next thing. And so if you run yourself completely down, because times are always, so far on farm, I have not had an easy year, but there's always something. And so if you run yourself down going, okay, I'm just going to get through this year and then I will be ready. You never know when the next crisis is around the corner. Okay. Yeah. And so I always talk about making sure that you are doing things, however small, to refill your personal battery on a regular basis is really important to being able to take on the next challenge. And when I talk to people about this, I just really emphasize that you have to be super, super honest with yourself. So you have to be realistic about what you're expecting of yourself. I know through experience that I need 7 hours of sleep a night. If I don't get that, I'm a wreck. I tried for many, many years to find ways around that. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
But also really taking that time, you know, when we do it, the notice it, name it, navigate it construct. If you take the time to really be honest about what's filling your batteries up and look for that nuance. So I love to talk on the phone. It fills me up. Talking on the phone to my sister really fills me up. She makes me laugh. We're ridiculous. Yep. I feel completely filled up. Hmm. If I call, you know, a neighbor and just talk on the phone, it's not going to give me that same boost. So looking for those high impact things that you can do for half an hour, or if you have the luxury, you know, you're working your butt off for a month and then you can go on a week-long hunting trip, whatever it is, making those investments yourself is one of the best resilience investments you can make for your business too.
And one of the small things that I've done, and it is small, but it is something that's taken me, I don't know, what, 30 years or 40 years of working to do, is actually prioritizing those things in my diary. For instance, you know, I have put in my diary that I go to the gym, and I don't, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm no gym junkie, twice a week for an hour. And they are in my diary and they can't be, well, hopefully not overridden too much, but, you know, basically all the holidays are in the diary. They are not negotiable.
Yes. Yeah. Having good boundaries is one of the best ways to actually establish self-care, is just going, look, this is my gym time. I am not going to book a meeting during that time. I'm just not available. And you don't have to justify yourself to anybody.
Yeah, but it's interesting. It's so hard. I mean, I found that because of the work culture that we've grown up with, I was so hard to actually feel like I wasn't robbing Peter to pay Paul. I was sneaking off to the gym and people shouldn't know about that because I should be working.
Mm. Well, you talk about the cultures that we grew up with. Mm. I mean, I'm probably a little bit younger than you, but not by much. And it was, you know, I started my career and you went home at the end of the day and nobody could get you. I mean, it would be the very unusual boss who would actually call your landline at home to ask you something.
Yep.
And now we are accessible 24/7 and somebody can text you and they're expecting a response immediately. And so I don't think that we can take our cues on self-care from what we have done previously, prior to 2007, I'd say, in the advent of everybody having a smartphone, because it's just a completely different ballgame. So when we talk about our grandfathers working really hard, my grandfather worked really hard, probably 60 hours a week building billboards. You know, that was, he busted his butt But he went home at the end of the day, and that was it. And he took his weekends off, and he went to church all day on Sunday. Mm. And if people today, professionals today and farmers today, took every single evening off and weekend off, it would be a tremendous culture shift.
Good luck with that one.
Yeah, it's not happening, but it's just, it's there's a different expectation. We are very much more plugged in. And so carving out that hour for yourself to go to the gym doesn't mean that you're working less hard than your grandfather.
Yep. Joanne, listen, there's so much we could talk about here, and I really have enjoyed today's podcast. I think we've hopefully looked at a few things. I'm looking forward to you coming out here in May and exploring this at our leadership course. So thank you very much for today.
Thank you. I really enjoyed this.
Cheers, Joanne. Thanks for listening to this week's Marcus Oldham College Ag Talk podcast. Please, any feedback on the series would be greatly appreciated. You can either leave a message on the site or email me at cornish@marcusoldham.vic.edu.au. Stay tuned as we continue to explore issues affecting Australian agribusiness.